Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering. Go to bellacatering.com.au if you're in the greater Sydney area to check it out. And why are you cooking? Just order in, you maniac. What's wrong with you? This is one of the maddest episodes of this show that has ever been done. It features one of my favorite human beings, artists, critical minds of all time. And this man's unfathomable ability to bring people joy in the work that he does and find joy and find that connection, that indelible connection that movies make, is unfathomable to me. He's a powerhouse. It's Matt Zolozites. A 1 8-minute series would not be the same without him. Enjoy this circus.
Whoever it is who wrote that note wants to meet us here tonight?
This is so cool, Bart. We're just like Woodward and Bernstein.
Yeah, except their dad wasn't waiting in the car reading Archie comics.
Stuck up Riverdale punks. Think they're too good for me.
You're on the right track. Follow the names.
How the hell do you know?
I can't tell you who I am, but I worked on the campaign.
Hey, Mr. Smithers!
Well, you might as well give me a ride home now.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is... he's a mensch. In the nicest possible way. In Australia, we didn't understand what this word meant until like a few years ago, but like we now know what it means, and he's kind of a film Twitter movie mensch. He's...
Are you describing a third guest who will arrive shortly?
No, I'm describing the man who sits in front of me. He's just an absolute towering film mind, and we all love him. And I'm so grateful that he's on the show because I would have been devastated not to have him on another one, Heat Minute Production. I'm excited that he's going to be doing, by the time you are listening to this, you would have heard him already on one Heat Minute, on Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, on Increment Vice, and now you're hearing him on All the President's Minutes, and it's just a treat. He's one of my favorite film critics alive. Matt Zolozites, welcome back to a one-hit
Hey, Blake.
How are you?
I'll try not to drool after that introduction.
Well, you know, I opened my mouth
on a frog.
In the nicest possible way, I love you. I love you. I'm so glad that you're doing the show. And what a movie to talk about for 2020 is probably a good way to start.
What can you say? What can you say? I mean, I'm getting to the point where I don't even like to say the year that we're in. He who shall not be named in Harry Potter. Which, by the way, the way J.K. Rowling is carrying on, we're not going to be able to say the name of those books either. The series that shall not be named.
Oh, man. it's like every day I spoke to probably a mutual person that we've both interacted with, and he's been on One Hit Minute, Jordan Harper, who's a terrific author and a screenwriter. And Jordan said there's a piece of graffiti that's near his house that just said, "What's next?" And he's seen that graffiti, like, as he's gone past to, like, go out for, you know, his fortnightly or weekly, like, shopping run. And it's still there, and it's been there after a few new wrinkles in this whole madness. It's like, you know, the fires in Australia, as some folk would know when I kicked this off, and then COVID, and then all of the social upheaval and everything that's going on. And it's just like, he just goes, I keep seeing it, and that keeps standing like the Berlin Wall. It's just like, or something. It's like, what's next? Who knows what's next, man? That street artist doesn't realize that they're a poet at the same time. It's just incredible.
That's what you would call, that's the street art version of what we would call an evergreen tweet.
Evergreen graffiti tag. Holy shit.
Evergreen graffiti.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
I can't even begin to tell you. I started rewatching Deadwood, and the episode where Wild Bill is assassinated, you know, spoiler alert for something that happened in the 1880s in Deadwood. It's one of the most incredible episodes of television I've ever seen. And that last section where they're chasing the assassin through the town and dragging him down in the mud, and like the entire town is kind of becoming one collective organism for the first time.
Yes.
On the show. And at that exact moment, a guy rides into town with a severed Native American head that they're trying to use to, like, stir up, you know, animosity against the indigenous people. And he can't even get their attention.
Yes.
He can't even get their attention. There's a guy on horseback, and he's waving a severed head around going, woo, woo. People are like, whatever, dude. That's 2020. That's 2020. I mean, there are things that we'd be talking about them for weeks, and they're like gone in 3 days. Like, did you hear the president opened up his shirt to reveal Kuato, the Martian leader from Total Recall? I'm like, no, I didn't see that. Do you have a link? You know, I mean,
I was like, I don't know what doom scrolling hellhole you went down today, but that just didn't happen to jump into my feed. It's like, I can't follow everything. I can't follow everything.
But, I mean, you know, really, when it's about, you know, like Lindsey Graham, just last week, Lindsey Graham, like the revelations, I was like, oh, that's interesting. That would have been the hugest story in like 1995. We would have never shut up about it. Now it's like, did something happen with Lindsey Graham? I can't remember.
There's a journalist in Australia, so the New York Times op-ed piece, which stirred up a whole bunch of controversy and apt controversy at the time for someone coming in with like, well, you know, there are good people on both the good people on both sides op-ed piece that caused so much hell. There's an Australian equivalent. There's like in our conservative paper, which is titled The Australian. Someone wrote an op-ed piece where Australian First Nations people used to be called Aboriginals, but the term kind of got co-opted as like an abusive term. So, you know, now when we call First Nations people in Australia, we say Indigenous or Torres Strait Islanders, and that's kind of just the standard. So a white guy in The Australian, one of our biggest publications on the weekend, says that all the problems with, and this is his exact quote, all the problems with Aboriginals and Negroes are their own.
And what, is it 1955 now? What's happening?
I was like, you know, the only thing that may save this guy's career is the rest of the shit that is happening in the world right now that people might miss that. And like in Australia, it's having all the journos are having our same moment that journos with the Times did, which is like, how in 2020, does that happen? And then the answer ultimately is, well, it's 2020. Of course. Of course.
It's 2020, but it's also, you know what? It's also eternally 1920 and 1820 on the inside of some people. So, you know, what can you say? But, you know, so I did a little reading before this podcast to get to refresh my memory about the film and some historical events. I didn't rewatch the movie because I've seen it so many times. I figured I'm good, but wow. I mean, these events happened almost 50 years ago, I'm not going to say what people think. I'm going to say that it seems like it happened 1,000 years ago, because the very idea that in the United States of America, Republicans and Democrats could look at the behavior of a president and go, yeah, this guy's got to go. I'm sorry for what this is going to do to my party, but I'm going to have to cross the aisle, is inconceivable. It is truly inconceivable. And I know we got to this point incrementally, but, and also the idea that you could get a president on tape talking about immoral or illegal or bigoted things, and that would be the end of them.
And that's enough. No, now they have a press conference and do that.
Think about all these movies. God bless them. Oh, I feel bad. All these movies over the last century that have ended with somebody going, put the tape in. And you see the guy who's running for mayor was like, I hate the blacks, blah, blah, blah. And the audience is like, he's horrible. We can't vote for him.
Oh, my God.
That doesn't happen.
That's the striking thing, right? At the beginning of this, you know, and it's that, this is the beautiful alchemy of this movie, is that sometimes it's such a salve. It feels so immediate. It feels so refreshing to be like, this is such a now movie, but you're so right. That's the thing. I think ultimately when I'm sort of unpacking why it is a salve is because you're like, remember when people just could sit down and have a moral, like a morality conversation, like, is it right that this is happening? Yes or no? And so many of these beautifully played witnesses in these bit parts, these actors that come in and just crush the whole movie and they're in it for one scene, are those moral moments where they sit down and they say, you know, I'm a Republican, but this goes beyond party politics. And that is...
Yeah, or like the moment in Beatrice Straight's scene in Network, where she comes in, she only has one scene, but she's kind of the conscience of the whole film. Yes. And... you know, Do the Right Thing has several scenes like that, although, you know, it's not quite as clear cut as some people would think. But yeah, and it's just really, you know, I should say here, and I think a lot of people would assume otherwise, but, you know, I was actually supported Bill Clinton's impeachment. Like, I didn't think it was like really an impeachable offense. Like even the obstruction and all that stuff, I felt like compared to Watergate, it was so minor, and there was clearly a more partisan, like, we can get him this way, let's get him kind of thing. But that being said, the guy lied under oath.
Yes.
He lied under oath. And like, and I keep having conversations with my progressive and liberal friends to the effect of, well, they're so much clearly worse than we are, and all of that. And like, I just think, like, look, if you lie under, if you're the president of the United States and you lie under oath, which is the single most basic thing they tell you not to do, that's like the beginning of every other criminal investigation. Is it starts by saying, do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? And you go, I do. And if you lie after that, you shouldn't be president.
Yes.
You shouldn't be president. And I feel like, you know, we should return to that standard, and everybody should be on board with it. And obviously people are complicated, and sometimes presidents have to do bad things for the greater good. But like, when you have a really clear cut case where like they swore on a Bible and said they wouldn't do something and then they do it, they should go.
Yeah. It's like, there are obviously grades of whatever the offense is, but if you're asked and you're the president, you've got to role model what the behavior you aspire the rest of the country to do. So it's like you're ultimately setting an example for every person who swears on that Bible from then on. Like, can you, like, that's the MO, is like, you're there going, what example am I going to set? And if the example is I'm going to lie under oath to try and protect scandalous things, even though they might be relatively minor in the grand scheme of things, it's like, you lied, man. You could have right then and there.
Yes, said it invites the not unreasonable question, well, what else has he lied about? What else is he going to lie about? Exactly. I mean, and it's different from, like, the Russians say, do you have a new top secret nuclear submarine that is invisible to radar? And you, the president, say, no, we have no such thing. Like, that's different.
That's different.
That's different.
That's national security. That's different. That's national security. That's going, you know, that's classified or whatever. And you don't have to say it to a foreign power, whatever the case may be. But, you know, did you? It seems pretty innocuous. Like, did you have sexual relations with this woman? No. Yes. Yes, I did.
No. And, you know, and I just feel like we are, I don't know who coined the phrase, but we're living in a post-truth environment. Like, the truth doesn't matter, and that's why I don't have any patience. And God, when you're on Twitter, you see these kind of conversations all the time. I have no patience for these conversations that people try to start with, like, well, in 2017 Donald Trump said X, and look, just last week he said Y. Contradiction. I'm like, do you think anybody cares at this point? Do you think his own people are gonna be like, the president contradicted himself, he's got to go? That's not gonna happen. The truth doesn't matter. It's like, we are I think it's a huge mistake to say that we're a secular country. We're not. We are a religious country. And I don't just mean because evangelical Christians have so much power in the government, but also because we are not a rational country. We are tribal, and we have certain belief systems that have taken the place of religion. And we can see the example of where that gets us right now, that you cannot have a conversation based on facts, ethics, morals, or behavior. And people on the left are guilty of this too. And you know, and I got in a lot of arguments about, God, I've already blocked his name out. Those freaking Saturday Night Live guy became a Minnesota senator.
Oh, Al Franken. Yeah.
See that? See what I did? I had erased his name from my mind.
Oh, God.
You know, but Al Franken, like, you know, he was accused of being sexual misconduct with a woman, and then more women came forward, and there were a lot.
Yeah.
And I kept getting in arguments with people. It's like, well, it's one photo, and it was clearly in jest. And it's like, yeah, but there's all these other stories attached to it, and this is the era of Me Too, and we're supposed to be better than a president that elected a groper.
Yes.
And apparently, you know, now we have another groper representing the Democrats. It's bad, man. It's really, really bad. And it's like, ugh. And yeah, of course I'm going to vote for Biden. Like, I'd vote for a ham sandwich with a little mold on the corner of it if that was the Democratic nominee.
I just imagine.
Running against Trump, I'd be phone banked for the moldy sandwich.
All I think about is the Simpsons and the inanimate carbon rod. I would vote for the rod. Like, give me the rod. Oh, my goodness.
I was like, you know, it'd be like 6 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. I'm cold calling people. Like, can I, do you have a minute for me to talk to you about the moldy sandwiches platform? For starters, the sandwich is pro equality.
the moldy sandwich, the mold is indiscriminate. Okay.
Contrary to what you may heard, he's not in the pocket of Big Mustard. At some point, we're going to talk about food. I'm sorry. The sandwich is in a debate with Trump, and like the top piece of bread moves like a mouth.
Look, you're a fan.
I ran reluctantly. You know, I was drafted.
Oh,
I was in my private life as a sandwich, but then the Democratic Party came to me and
said, this is the only thing we can agree on. The only thing is that this ham sandwich was good. It's now a bit moldy, but this is the fact. This is the only thing we can agree on right now. Oh, my goodness.
If Trump did debate the sandwich, you know, the entire time he'd be looking at the sandwich going, I don't know, it doesn't look that moldy. I'm kind of hungry.
You know that debate ends with him eating the sandwich. That's what's going to happen.
It does. Well, I'm just thinking, like, Of course, my mind immediately goes to The Simpsons, and I ask myself, what would Homer do? You know, Homer would eat a sandwich. No question.
He just keeps eating that gigantic moldy sandwich over and over again, even though it makes him sick.
My favorite gag from the entire run of the show is when he's down in the basement looking at the moldy sandwich with the toadstool growing out of it that he's thrown away, and Marge calls down to the basement, Homie! Are you eating that sandwich again? And there's a pause, and then Homer goes, no.
We don't need to talk about this movie. This is too much fun. This is too much fun.
President's Men. Oh. How quaint. What an adorable little morality play it is. Yes.
And
yes, the reporters, by the way, who are supported by a robust infrastructure of journalism that is dedicated to investigative reporting and ferreting out the truth and has the resources to conduct it competently.
Yes.
Uncovers this vast story of government malfeasance and then presents it to the public, and the public so outraged that they turn on the president, and people in the president's own party turn on the president, and eventually the president resigns or face impeachment and removal. I mean, we can file this under fantasy, right?
I remember it's like when the Lance Armstrong revelations came out, my favorite genre of tweet was bookstores taking his autobiography and taking it and putting it in the fantasy section and then taking a photograph and tweeting it. And I just feel like this movie, like, it's just begging. It's begging for, like, this sort of docudrama to just be moved into fantasy right now, because that's what it feels like. Like that.
It might as well.
And, you know, I talk to friends of ours, mutual friends like Sean Burns, and Sean says about how his parents, I think it was his dad, would buy the transcripts from the tapes and the transcripts from the court cases, and the, you know, they would form like doorstops in their house because the public was so enraptured.
I gotta tell you something. I was born in 1968. Watergate happened when I was a kid. I didn't really understand what was going on, but I became fascinated by it in middle school and high school. And I actually started reading the transcripts and I did. And it was, I can't remember who had it. I think it was my dad. And I became this weird, like, Wes Anderson character. I was like, and can we even believe John Ehrlichman? You know, I was like, what do you think's on the 18 minutes? And they're like, we're trying to play kickball, man. Can we just put a sock in it for 2 minutes? And like, what do you think? If he hadn't resigned, do you think they would have removed him? And it's like, you're can you just finish the test first and then we'll discuss it?
Oh my God. I could just imagine you, like, bottle rocket era, a beret, and just asking grown adults, like, interrogating them about Watergate.
There was a guy named Mr. Washington who was my instructor in the ninth grade. I went to this government and law magnet high school before I decided to become a visual artist and a writer. And it was a crazy, like, super nerdy school, in the public school in Dallas. But Mr. Washington was the guy who supervised the second half of the day where we studied the law, like all the different kinds of law. It was really interesting, and it actually has benefited me to this day. And like, he became my Watergate buddy. Like, as soon as one day I was like, in the seventh and eighth grade, it was like, it's a kid who won't shut up about Watergate and Vietnam. And then I got to the law and government magnet, and I was surrounded by people who were just like me. It was great. And one day, I'll never forget this, one day, like, Mr. Washington and I are sitting around after class, and I said, like, do you think Nixon would have been impeached and removed if he hadn't resigned? And his eyes got really wide, and he's like, and he goes, let me lay it out for you. And he had this whole, like, how things would have played out.
I love any story, any script, anything where someone says the line, let me lay it out for you. Like,
let me lay it out for you. It was like something out of All the President's Men.
That's exactly that. If someone says that, I'm like, I'm so in. That's like the Donald Sutherland, Kevin Costner scene in Oliver Stone's JFK, which I love so much. Like, he goes, but to do everything except to say, let me lay it out for you. He's just like,
It was great. And it was like he was my drug supplier. Like, he was giving me like additional reading on Watergate. He's like, have you ever read Will G. Gordon Liddy? That's some crazy shit, man. I'm like, no, lay it on me, brother. Lay it on me. I got it. I'm like reading it on the bus on the way home. I'm like, God, this guy's off his rocker.
Oh my goodness.
Can you just shut up and eat your pork chops and stop talking about Waterdeep for 15 minutes?
Your dad, the great jazz artist that he is, like tinkering away on a piano, you're tapping him on the shoulder. Dad, I just read this great biography on G. Jordan Liddy. And he's like, get out of here. Get out.
Yeah. Well, but if I'd said Miles Davis, it would have been a different story.
He would have went, stop. That's what it is.
Oh, so the parking garage.
The parking garage. We are... Wow. I'm just having too much fun. I forgot there was even a show that we were doing. I thought we were just talking. No,
I feel like, you know, when the ship is starting to cross the equator line, we need to try to steer it back.
Yeah, let's get back to North America. Look, we are, for folks listening, this is, you're going to be listening to this quite some time after Matt and I record it. So I hope it's a beautiful little slice of nostalgia for maybe a slightly better part of 2020, because as it's projected, you know, there's going to be an asteroid, an alien invasion, an earthquake, a tidal wave, a tsunami, you know, whatever else you can imagine in Roland Emmerich's, you know, visual board of inspiration in his house, something's going to happen. But it's the 105th minute. We've just seen the incredible scene between Segretti and Bernstein in his apartment, and they're sort of unpacking, because the malfeasance of the presidency in the Republican Party at the time to undercut and do nasty things to sort of to throw their opponents off any momentum that they were going to be building, they don't know how far that goes. They don't know what's happening. And so once again, it's one of the rare scenes that we get back into this parking garage. It's an absolutely ripper of a scene. I think we're going to watch it together. We'll watch it right now, and then we'll come back and unpack it. I think that might be the only way that you and I are going to get back on track, because I just want to talk more about your teacher giving you books. I want to talk more about Deadwood. I want to talk about all the things that we've digressed upon, but I think this will be a beautiful moment for us to check in with Robert Redford and Hal Holbrook in the garage. Let's do it.
All right.
Rat fucking. In my day, it was simply known as the double cross. In our present context, it means infiltration of the Democrats.
Segretti won't go on the record. But if he would, we know he would implicate Chapin.
And that would put you inside the White House.
Be specific. How high up?
You'll have to find that out for yourself. I don't like newspapers. I don't care for inexactitude and shallowness.
A creep slush fund that financed the rat fucking. You just about got that nailed down. I don't know how.
Did you change?
I don't like inexactitudes. I don't like newspapers. And did you change cabs? Bless.
Have you talked about the real guy, the real deep throat?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about Mark Felt, a little bit. But I'd love to talk about it, knowing that you're a geek on it. It's great. And we have talked a little bit about the terrible Liam Neeson movie that was made about Mark Felt, which is available right now for people if you want to watch.
Well, I don't want to repeat too much of what's been covered already on this, but essentially, Mark Felt, the associate director of the FBI, was revealed as Deep Throat in 2005, and prior to that, there had been some skepticism about whether or not this Deep Throat person even existed, and the editor of the All the President's Men book, which was derived from the original Washington Post reporting, said that there was no Deep Throat character in the book. And a lot of people, particularly Republicans who were mad that Nixon was no longer the president, speculated that they just made this guy up, or that...
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
He was a composite. And that it made the story more, I guess, literary or cinematic or something, and that it was a composite. And they said, no, he's a real person. We can't tell you who he is because we've been promised that we wouldn't reveal his identity until after his death or until the point arrived when he said that it was okay. And eventually, 31 years after Nixon's resignation and 11 years before he died, an attorney for Phelps' family confirmed that he was Deep Throat. And of course, that didn't settle the matter. There are still people who say, well, he's not really Deep Throat. There's really some other explanation. But I think we can accept that, yes, if a guy is was the associate director of the FBI during Watergate, then, yeah, there's a possibility that he might actually have some good intel to give to some reporters if he thought that the president represented a threat to the country, which he did. So that's it. And, you know, but of course, the way that Hal Holbrook plays that guy and the way that he's lit and the way those scenes are staged turns him into this. No wonder people wondered if he was real.
Yes.
I mean, the way they shoot that scene, like those are the most movie-like scenes in the movie. The rest of the movie is very good for the most part about presenting things in a naturalistic way as if it's something that could actually happen. It's only the Deep Throat scenes that feel like there's a whiff of bullshit to them.
Yes.
And that's not a bad thing. It's not detrimental to the movie, but there's definitely, like, even the first time I saw it, you know, I think I was probably 14, you know, deep in my Watergate obsession. And I remember thinking, like, I wonder if that's exactly how it happened.
Yes.
You know, like in a parking garage and he's smoking a cigarette and wearing a trench coat and there's blue light on his face and all that. And, you know, for years and years, I stopped doing it because basically people don't kind of really care about Watergate anymore and nobody was getting the joke. But for years, when I used to smoke, if I went to a movie with somebody and we parked the car, I would deliberately walk a little bit behind them and then I would hide behind a pillar or other obstruction. They go, Matt, where are you? And I would step out from behind it and stand under a light and light a cigarette and go, let me lay it on you.
There's not enough of that. There's not enough of that. I only want to be in a parking garage smoking and saying, let me lay it on you. Well, back in my time, it was called the double cross.
Listen to me say, are we going to go to Wendy's or not? Listen to me. This goes straight to the top. Can we discuss it over chili fries?
That'll put you inside the White House, Matt. That'll put you inside the White House.
Exactly. It was like, that'll put you inside of the Wendy's. Yeah. Yeah, but you know, it's astounding to me how much impact this scene, these parking garage moments had on popular culture. It's staggering.
Yes.
It's the default place for sensitive information to be conveyed to the intrepid heroes of the movie. And like the X-Files did variations of it a million times. The finale of The Americans, like the, arguably the dramatic peak of the entire series occurs in a parking garage. And it's not, you know, a source like spilling beans to a reporter, but absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any possible way that the people who made that scene were thinking about all the president's men when they were lighting that parking garage.
I've only just started The Americans. I'm way, way behind. And largely because I've been reading so much praise of it. And it's a show that is steeped in this, the style of the whole, yeah, like the authenticity, but then also this, you know, these moments that get that pure cinema moment, as you described it before. It's sensational.
It is. And you know, it's funny, right before I joined you for this podcast, I was sitting in the living room eating dinner with my children. I have five kids between the ages of 15 and 23. And we were eating pork chops.
Guys, let me lay it on.
Yeah. Like, Dad, can you shut up about Watergate for 5 minutes? But we were watching The Simpsons, and it's the episode where Sideshow Bob gets out of prison for the 38th time, and he runs for mayor against Mayor Quimby. Oh. And there's a in the parking lot. There's a scene in the parking lot with Smithers, Burns' assistant, and he's wearing a trench coat, smoking a cigarette. And I thought, how fortuitous that we should be watching this.
This is what, you know, I think even in the States, and you talk about pop culture dominance, I don't think people know how much The Simpsons was played in Australia. So there are so many movies still to this day that, like, I will watch a reference, I'll watch it and I'll go, oh my God, that was a Simpsons reference. I'm still piecing them together because some of them are, you know, Barney smothering Homer with a pillow and then smashing a fountain out the window and running off into the hills, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest style, which you cannot possibly understand as like a seven-year-old. You cannot understand that that's what it is. But then some of them are like that with Smithers where it's just like, oh, we've got a garage scene. Of course he's smoking. Of course he's going to be lit just at the eyes. Of course he's wearing a trench coat because that's our language of, you know, espionage and insiders and inside sources.
It is. And, you know, what's really funny about that is that, you know, because The Simpsons is basically the Smithsonian of television, like it's become this incredible repository. Like I've actually come to believe that the only reason that knowledge of classic cinema hasn't been completely wiped out already is because of The Simpsons. Because I can't tell you how many times that one of my kids has been introduced to something, some classic piece of cinema from another decade by The Simpsons, and then gone down a rabbit hole. Like, you know, just a few weeks ago, we were watching Rear Window. I said, let's all watch Rear Window. It's really good. And they're actually pretty open-minded about old movies. They know that I don't show them an old movie. I don't think there's at least a chance they'll like it. And they loved Rear Window. But immediately, within like 5 minutes, one of them was like, this is the episode of The Simpsons where Bart breaks his leg. I'm like, it is.
That's how we all come to know it. That's how we all come to
know it. I got to tell you, since we're going on tangents and allowing ourselves to, I got to tell you about my one of my boys, his obsession with Psycho. He was about 8 years old. I'm walking him to school and he's humming. And I'm like, are you humming the theme to Psycho? He says, what's Psycho? And I said, it's a movie by Alfred Hitchcock. It's a very scary movie. You didn't see Psycho, did you? And he said, I don't know what that is. He's like, I'm singing some music that I heard on The Simpsons. And I remembered, oh, yeah, they made constant Hitchcock jokes on The Simpsons, and Psycho particularly got a workout. And I said, no, that's from a movie. Like, whenever they play that piece of music, and I hummed a couple of other things, I said, that's from the soundtrack to Psycho by Bernard Herrmann. And he said, can I see Psycho? And I said, no, you're 8. But I'll tell you sort of generally what it's about. I eventually did let him watch it. I think it was like 11 or something. Yeah. Will you give me the movie? And I said, no, I told you can't see it. And he said, well, can I get the album? Can I get the CD? And I said, yeah. And I bought him the Psycho soundtrack CD and he played it like on endless repeat while he was building with his Legos. And people would come over to the house and they hear the Psycho music blasting in the back of the house. They go, what's going on back there? And I'm like, oh, it's just my son. He loves Psycho. And then he finally got
his impeccable taste for a soundtrack. My God.
He finally got to see Psycho with his sister, and they both loved it. And it was a great experience because I was in the kitchen cooking dinner while they were watching it, and neither of them knew anything about the plot. And I felt like I was listening to people in 1960 watching Psycho. They had absolutely no idea what was coming. They thought Janet Leigh was the hero and she was going to be in the whole film. And it was great. It was like an absolutely pristine viewing experience for the both of them. And then after that, James started like messing with my brain, and he would do things like he would be blasting the Psycho music, and he would wait for me to like walk over to the part of the living room where I could see down the hallway, and he had turned off all the lights except for the bathroom so that he was silhouetted and he was just standing in the doorway motionless. And I was like, James, what's going on, man? And he didn't respond. I'm like, James? And he's like, ha, 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 I got you.
The peak
was when I was cooking dinner. It was winter, and you know when you cooked, we were on the second floor, and like if you don't crack the window, it fogs up, right?
Yeah.
And the window to the terrace was right next to the refrigerator, and I opened the door to the refrigerator, and James is in the kitchen, and I opened the door to the refrigerator, got some stuff out, and then I closed the refrigerator door, and I noticed there was writing in the steam, and I looked, and it said, "I will kill them all," and I was like, Jesus Christ. I looked over and James was like, ha, ha, I got you again.
I just want to say I've now got a 3.5-year-old and an almost 2-year-old. And that those parenting stories, forget people who are like, read your kids' stories, do this and that. I can't wait to terrify them with proper scary movies and to watch their minds get blown by introducing films that, you know, to your point, I think you made that point of like, you know, films pre the 2000s, that people just seem to have an aversion to naturally rewatch. And I think that that's been such a joy with me with The Simpsons. And I literally, you know, I was talking to my wife the other day about it. It was so funny that we're talking about it now. It's just like, there are so many references in The Simpsons that I found later and like was blown away and then had to find, you know, it was a lot harder to go back and find, you know, now at least you can stream them, but it was so hard to like, oh, I've got to go back to that DVD episode in season 5 because that's where that reference is from. And I have to watch it right now because it, you know, you see it in everything. And it's like the films that Quentin Tarantino sort of absorbed with Pulp Fiction. You know, people watch Pulp Fiction and then they see all the carbon copies and then they see the original films that he sort of lifted from, if you like. And you're like, oh, this is Pulp Fiction. Well, it's one of those.
Well, but of course, people like him and Scorsese and Spike Lee and other people who are very kind of Brechtian in the way that they showcase their references. Part of the reason for that, it's not just that they love something and want to say, hey, I love this thing, but it's also they want to share the thing and they want to create more fans of whatever the thing is. And I feel like they're, unfortunately, filmmakers are only moderately successful when they do this because a lot of people just aren't curious. They're just not curious people. And if people were curious, Star Wars would have created a much bigger fan base for John Ford and Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah.
You know, like as it is, people may know, oh yeah, Star Wars. There are quotes from The Searchers, a John Ford film, in that movie. It's like, have you ever seen a John Ford film? No. Why not? There's like 50 of them.
and
any one of them.
And at least 20 of them are great. At least.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, he wasn't batting a bad average, you know, like 2 out of 5 were like five stars.
How can you not want to consume everything Kurosawa ever made? If you love Star Wars and you find out that it's basically a, you know, at least 50% an uncredited remake of an Akira Kurosawa film. I don't know. I think it's a lot of fun to figure out the component parts that things are made from and look at them, go back and look at the original. And then you realize that the original is also usually a composite of some other influences. It's kind of what art is. And it's not, you know, I used to think it was depressing, but now I think it's just inevitable that people see things in a Scorsese film or a Tarantino film, or more recently, like Spike Lee's To Five Bloods. And they say, oh, that's a reference to Apocalypse Now or whatever. And it is. But, you know, Apocalypse Now is not the first movie to use Ride of the Valkyries in a big showboating, auteur, watch me kind of sequence. Fellini did it before in 8.5.
Yes.
And that's where Coppola got it from. And Coppola always wanted to be Fellini. Like, that's why he carried on like the ringmaster Ambrosio of cinema for a long time. I love Coppola, but it's like, Coppola wanted to be Fellini. He wanted to be Visconti. He wanted to be all of these great Italian with a capital I filmmakers. And it's funny that now you hear Ride of the Valkyries and you think Apocalypse Now. And of course, a lot of people may not even know what that movie is, and they may think it's a reference to Rango, which also has. Remember
that? Yes.
The Ride of the Valkyries in Rango was great. It was rescored on a banjo. Sorry to keep bringing us off the track here, but.
No, this is exactly what. This is exactly the kind of conversation that I hope to have with you about any movie. It's we load it up with tangents, but that's what I there's a really great, and I think you would love it, Matt. So if you can track it down, I'd love you to. There's an Australian TV show called Bluey. It's for little kids, and it's each episode is 7 minutes long. I don't know how All the President's Minutes is talking about Bluey now, but this is a good tangent. And we're talking about intertextuality, and each episode is 7 minutes long, and it's about a young family of blue cattle dogs. So it's a dog family, and the whole universe is full of dogs. And the guy, the lead creator behind it, is two guys. There's a producer called Daly Pearson, who's excellent, making some really exciting stuff out of Oz. But the key creative is like a sort of Trey Parker-esque guy named Joe Brum, who writes every single episode. And he's a dad, a father of two girls, and it's a little family. The dad's name's Bandit, the mum's name's Chili, and the daughter is named Bluey and Bingo. And that show, there's a recent episode that they call Flat Pack. It's about the family go to IKEA and come back to build something together. And the mum and dad are fighting, building this thing, and it's very adorable. But what it ends up being, it's like the theory of, like, Darwinian theory of evolution, ending with, like, projections of the Sistine Chapel in heaven, entangled in this cartoon. And when I first watched it, not only did it make me well up as a, you know, I watch this show every day. I just want to say I watch it every day, at least 3 or 4 episodes with my kids. It's their pre-bedtime ritual. The two kids watch it before they go to bed. And it's so, like, the ability for kids shows to do that. And there's another episode called Sleepy Time, which it basically is this insane, you know, references to like Apocalypse Now, to 2001 A Space Odyssey, to Sunshine. It's like just visual references. It's absolutely stunning. And I think you would get a real kick out of it because some episodes are super intertextual and some of them are just really great, like things. And another one that's like a mini Vietnam movie called Army, where these two kids are at daycare together and they go and pretend they're on patrol. And it's incredible. So if you get a chance to check it out, like, it would be fun for you to check out. As a parent, I have so much fun watching it. I'm like, I can't stand Paw Patrol or some of those other shows. They make me want to kill myself watching it. It's just the most awful crap. But something like Bluey, you know, I would love you to check it out because it's that. And so when I'm watching it, there's a couple of these episodes where I'm like, that guy's a genius. Whoever he, like Joe Brum, this mysterious figure, I'm like, that guy's a genius. He's telling these really beautiful and insightful stories, and this intertextuality is him, like, you know, I love being able to observe the subliminal messages going into my kids' heads. And later, and they even do an episode called Zoo where the dad Bandit pretends he's an ape that's escaped, and it's like a mini King Kong story.
That's great.
And it's just beautiful. Like, there's so many fun things that are happening there. But it's the real great children's TV and filmmakers have the most fun, like Rango, with having a Ride of the Valkyries and banjos and stuff like that.
Yeah, Rango was a particularly good experience because I saw that actually with my son James, and we had gone to see a different movie. There was a movie called Battle LA, which I don't know if you even remember.
It was like an alien invasion. Did it have like Aaron Eckhart or something like that in it?
Yeah, and it was not good. And it was in fact, it had some of the worst shaky cam photography I've ever seen. In fact, my son, who was just a little kid, I looked over at him and he looked really sad and bored. And I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "I don't know what's going on." And I said, "It's an alien invasion movie. They're fighting the aliens." He said, "No, I mean, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's happening." And I realized that I really didn't either. And it was because the filmmaking was so bad. And there was a scene where like Aaron Eckhart was doing, he was just doing push-ups, and there were like 7 different camera angles and they were all shaky. And I was like, ugh. And he said, "Do we have stay here? And I said, no. And he said, you can leave? And I said, yeah, you can leave a movie. There's no law that says you don't have to. And he said, well, let's leave. And I said, okay. And I left and I asked for a refund. And, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but you can get a refund for almost anything as long as you're not too deep into the movie. And I went into the lobby and I said, would it be okay if we got a refund or just exchanged our tickets for something else? This movie, and he was like, what's wrong? We're like, we both really hate the movie. And the guy, the manager was like, it's fine, I don't care. And he said, do you want your money back or do you want to see a different movie? And I said, what's playing? And the movie that was playing, it's like 10 minutes from now, Rango. And I was like, let's go see Rango. And man, am I glad I did.
Great.
That's a great movie. I mean, Gore Verbinski, more people should be talking about Gore Verbinski.
Yeah.
I don't even know if there's a place for that person in Hollywood now. Like, he was making like extremely expensive films and in some cases like franchise films, like the pirate films, but they're really weird.
They are weird.
They're truly weird films and they're funny and exciting, but they're just fucked up. Like, in a good way. There's really like a lot of Chris in his movies, you're like, what? I would like to get a glimpse inside the brain tissue of the person who came up with something like this. I mean, there was a while there where he was kind of giving me what I used to get from Tim Burton.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And they were giving him the money to do it. That's what was crazy. It's like he makes that first Pirates movie and it's deeply weird and great and like entanglements of like death and prophecy and class. And you're like, huh, this has something.
And you know how much I love The Lone Ranger.
Yes.
I love The Lone Ranger. Yeah. The Lone Ranger is it's a 70s pot western, like for the new millennium. It's a really strange film.
Deeply strange and hugely disgustingly violent as well in parts. And you're like, what is going on? This is not paid for kids.
And it's also like Big Trouble in Little China in that the hero is kind of useless a lot of the time.
Yes.
The white hero is useless.
Yeah, and Armie Hammer, that is his perfect role, the useless hero. He should on his resume, he should have that. Like he's perfect at that. He's really wonderful. All right, speaking of not so useless heroes, let's get back to really ever so briefly a fun story that I want to talk to you about is if you've ever seen Mark Felt. He looks exactly like Hal Holbrook. Like they could be doppelgangers for one another. And what's so crazy is in some of the lore of the making of this film, there's a hilarious moment where it's like Bob Woodward insisted on Hal Holbrook. Like there was a cachet of like some of the greatest character actors in the history of American cinema. They're all just lined up to wait in the wings to do this deep throat scene. They're all excited to just come on and play a couple of bit roles and get out of there. And he was very insistent. And so what's hilarious is that even in Bob Woodward's promise, if you like, that it was going to be very low key. What you know, they wouldn't reveal a source. He still was intent on picking the guy who looked most like the guy for authenticity reasons, which I just think is absolutely hilarious. It's like you pick the doppelganger for the guy, even though you want people not to know who he is.
That's really funny. I didn't know that.
And he's just so wonderful. And the other thing that we've talked a little bit about on the show before, and I wanted to get your take on it is, and we've sort of half mentioned it is, for someone like Gordon Willis, one of the greatest cinematographers who ever lived, he had the nickname Prince of Darkness. It's like, it's funny that you go from something like Parallax View, which is beautifully abstract and has these massive splashes of colors and this, you know, super oppressive zooms where Beatty looks like a tiny speck of an ant on the screen and everything else is so, you know, gargantuan around him. And it's like he comes to this very, very deeply authentic movie where everything is, you know, shot for realism. And it feels like, you know, this is Willis unleashed. You know, these car park scenes are like him getting to be, you know, get us into the subterranean world that doesn't feel real.
A scene like that, it's like, you know, a cinematographer who's so distinctive and so stylish and like you keep it under wraps, like a scene like that arrives and it's like in a Magic Mike movie when they rip off their tuxedo and there's, you know, and they start dancing. It's like, all right, the flyaway tuxedo, now we get the real Gordon Willis, you know, like when, like Robert Richardson.
Can I just say that is my favorite description of satisfaction. It's like in the Magic Mike movies when the tuxes get ripped off. It's like when Joe Manganiello takes his shirt off in the service station.
It is like, yeah, like, you know, basically, I think that, you know, Robert Richardson shooting Kill Bill or Natural Born Killers, it's like, it's basically 10 straight minutes of Channing Tatum.
Yes.
You know, gyrating. That's what it is. It's like, it's nothing handy, nothing but the fun. It's like, I remember filmmaker friends of mine used to kind of make fun of Robert Richardson because there was a period of about, I don't know, 10 years or something where every movie that he did, whenever there was anybody being interrogated, he would do the white hot shafts of light coming down from the ceiling, like it was the Lord judging them or something. And those things were so hot that the table or people's hair would catch fire. And I believe it happened on JFK. And in fact, a low budget movie that I produced, the cinematographer is like, let's do a Robert Richardson white hot shaft of light this scene. I'm like, are you sure? And he's like, yeah, let's do it. And it was a lawyer's office that we had borrowed. And we started to smell smoke when we realized that the intensity of that light, it was setting the documents on this lawyer's desk on fire. And we had to put it out.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So if the lawyer who's our office we borrowed is listening to this, yeah, we did that. That was us. I'm sorry. I don't know what became of the documents, but on the plus side, office is not burned to the ground. Well,
it's that beautiful warning that smoke will give you. Right? Like, this is about to catch fire. I smell smoke.
It was like, you know, like, yeah, who's eating mesquite grilled chicken? Not me. Ooh, must be something else.
Oh my God. Well, the last time we chatted, a very fond memory for me. Was that you accidentally, we were having so much fun talking that you accidentally burnt dumplings.
Yes.
and it made it like, as much as I was like, oh man, his lovely wife, Nance, and the kids are going to not be very happy with him at all for the burning those dumplings. But I had so much
fun. Looked like demon eggs. There was like nothing left. There was just charcoal for cats. It was like one of the kids didn't know I was making dumplings. They're like, what are those? I'm like, those are supposed to be dumplings. They're like, really?
I feel like with the smelling of smoke and that really fond memory, I think this is a great way to go and just say it has been an absolute treat talking to you again, my friend, about this movie and this minute. And having this conversation has just been amazing. So I just want to say thank you for being part of the show.
I feel the same way.
Isn't he just a treasure? Matt Zolazite, you can find him on Twitter at Matt, MATTZOLA, ZOLLER, Zites. You can go to MZSWorldStore.com and you can get signed copies of all of his amazing books. He's still a TV critic and for New York Magazine, an editor at large at RogerEbert.com, and he's currently making a documentary on his dad, Dave Zolazite. So look, just stay in touch with him. The best way is on Twitter. He's, you know, he's got a great following and he's a great interactor on there. You can find his stuff all over those different publications, but Twitter is a great portal to those things. I'm exceedingly grateful to know him and for his friendship and for him being a part of these mad things that we do. Thank you so much for listening, guys. One Blake Minute on Twitter and Instagram at ATPMPod for the show. OneHeatMinute.com for everything. And if you've got a little bit of scratch and you can afford to sponsor the show and help us continue to make our great productions, it is Patreon.com/OneHeatMinute. But tough times, so a share is massive, a retweet is massive, a recommendation to a friend, a review. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on another episode of All the President's Minutes very soon.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.